And welcome to Take 127 Overlooked on Ship Full of Bombs, Thames Delta Independent Radio, www.sfob.co.uk. Welcome.
Well done.
Well
Thank
done.
Thank you very
indeed.
Much indeed. Yeah. Didn't even have it written down.
It's like music kept better every time you hear it.
It does. It does. Yeah. I've been humming it all day.
Go on, Dan.
Again.
Do
no,
it.
I'm not going to do it.
Oh, it's like a Zen mantra.
It is. I love it. Yeah, so, okay, welcome to the show. My name is Dan. I am the host. There are two co-presenters. Introduce yourselves, chaps.
Hello, this is Mike. As usual, I'm here for your bozo uncle.
Yes, you are our bozo uncle.
And I'm Kirk, and I'm here to mispronounce as many words as I possibly can.
Excellent.
Oh, you've got some good ones coming up. Yeah. Here, yeah.
And, of course, we are ably assisted. I, you know what? Assisted isn't the right word, is it? What's the right word?
Hindered.
let's put it this way. The man without whom the show could not happen, it's Ian. Our engineer producer,
hello,
who's got no microphone this time because no. I've had to nick it. So yeah, okay, good. So we are going to crack on. We've got a couple of films that we need to talk about. We had a little bit of discussion about what the theme was for this particular episode, and there are potentially two themes. One theme is landscape. That's landscape.
Not the 80s band, by the way.
No. I nearly brought some that, you know. Einstein, no go-go.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because both films have quite beautiful, yet harsh, unforgiving, enormous, yet claustrophobic landscapes. So that was a good theme. The other theme as well is the theme of Lost. And that's because both films were lost for quite some time. They were unavailable to watch. They were unavailable on VHS or DVD. And they've only fairly recently become available once more. And as well as that, the characters in them are arguably all lost in some way.
Mm. Oh. That paints a picture, doesn't it?
It does. A powerful, powerful picture indeed.
Little do they know.
So, should we crack on then with the first one?
Indeed.
I'm going to tell people what it is, and I've got a little bit of a synopsis here. The film is Wake in Fright, 1971, directed by Ted Kotcheff. Who also directed 28 episodes of Armchair Theatre. You remember that? BBC, a British thriller anthology thing,
yeah,
in the 60s and 70s. 28 episodes he did of that. The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz, which I think may have been Richard Dreyfuss's first film, possibly. First Blood.
Rambo.
And last, and by no means least, Weekend at Bernie's, which is a fantastic
film. Oh, you've missed out funny Dick and Jane as well, with George Segal and Jane Fonda.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Oh, that was one of his?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he made a shed load, didn't he?
Oh, he's made lots and lots of films, and he's still working at the moment in TV. Yeah. It was written by Evan Jones, who is most famous probably for... Well, Wake in Fright and Funeral in Berlin and Champions. So
Champions?
Yes, Champions. You know the...
The TV show?
No, Champions. You know the John Hurt, Champion.
Yeah. Oh, Champion, yeah.
Based on a book by Kenneth Cook. It stars various people, including Gary Bond, Donald Pleasance, who's superb in it, Chips Rafferty, and Sylvia Kay, who was actually Ted Kotcheff's wife. I'm going to go through the summary very, very quickly then. Synopsis, if you will. John Grant is a teacher in a tiny Australian town called Tibunda, which consists of a schoolhouse, a hotel stroke pub, and nothing else. He's paid a $1,000 bond, which means that he's trapped working there until his contract is finished. Planning to travel to Sydney for the Christmas holidays, Grant boards a train to the nearest big town, Bundanyabba, known to everyone who lives there as the Yabba, for an overnight stay before heading to the airport in the morning. He goes for a beer and is befriended by the local chief of police, Jock Crawford, who pressures him into drinking too much. Soon, Grant is trapped in the Yabba, and over the course of the weekend, he spirals downwards into a nightmare of endless drinking, gambling, kangaroo shooting, and dark sexual encounters. That sounds amazing, doesn't
it? And it's all set at Christmas.
And it is all set at Christmas, yes. It would have been a good alternative Christmas film for our,
our Christmas special.
Our sister show, yes.
Nice cheery film for Christmas, yeah.
So, there we go. I mean, what do we want to say about it? Who wants to jump in? Who has some opinions on this?
We all have opinions, Dan.
We do all have opinions. Yes. Yeah. But I want to hear them, and the listener wants to hear them.
Oh, okay. I was just going to keep them to myself, but, you know.
So, go on. Who wants to jump in, then? What did we think of this movie?
Well, I mean, this is the first time I ever watched it, so I'd barely even heard of the film before viewing it the other night. And I have to say, it's one hell of a journey. You do. It's almost like you physically go through what happens in the film. You know, the
it's brutal.
Yeah, it is. It's totally unforgiving. In a kind of not in a bad way, but just that is the cut of the film, if you like. Mm. The editing is quick. You know, apart from maybe the opening scene and the closing scene, which are sort of panoramic shots,
yes.
but the rest of the film is very quickly edited. The pace moves along quite rapidly, and you do kind of feel like you've been drunken and beaten up and shot kangaroos and all the rest of it through. But after you've watched the film, you know, it's.
Can I just say, you mentioned the editing there. Interesting little thing here. Evan Williams in The Weekend Australian, he actually wrote something here specifically about the editing. He said, at a technical level, the film is masterly. The dusty, heat-throbbing outback landscapes are beautifully caught in Brian West's cinematography, and Tony Buckley's editing has wonderful fluidity and power. In more ways than one, this is Buckley's film. And apparently he was not a very... a particularly well-known editor. And when the first edit of the film was done, they actually got in a fairly famous editor. They said, right, we need you to come in, take a look at it, put the producers' minds at rest or tell them where it can be improved. So this guy, who was a master of the trade, watched the entire film and he just said at the end, I wouldn't change a thing.
I mean, it's a very the editing style is quite modern, actually, in style. You know, it's it could be like a Tarantino film or something of that ilk. You know, very very unusual for that period in cinema, really. I was kind of a little bit overwhelmed by the experience because, you know, we funny enough, just to set the scene for the listeners, we had quite a sober night. Ourselves, and it was almost because this film, which is based around drinking lots of copious amounts of beer and God knows what else, rum or anything available to hand, and we deliberately didn't drink that night, and I'm glad to say that I didn't, because I mean it's the sort of film that would put me off drinking for life.
Yeah, it put me off drinking until I got home that night.
I hastened out. I had a pint by the side of me, so
that long, huh? Goodness me. Yeah,
can we jump straight into the kangaroo hunting scenes?
Yeah.
Because I think that's the elephant in the room. Or the kangaroo in the room. I set myself up for that joke, didn't I? Because you wouldn't, but... It's real kangaroo killing footage. They do. There's a kind of disclaimer, or not disclaimer, a credit, but it's at the end of the film, funnily enough, it should be at the start.
Yeah.
To say this film has been approved by kind of animal welfare people because it shows a true representation of a professional kangaroo shoot.
Mm.
And I've seen this film twice now. First time I saw it, I was a little bit... When I know animals are going to be hurt, I'm a bit squeamish, I guess. Mm. So I was only half watching the plot and stuff. It's like, oh, is that real? Isn't that real? Oh, I don't think that definitely is real. Mm. So second time I watched it, knowing a little bit more about how they filmed it, as in... There were no animals directly hurt for making the film.
Hmm.
Apparently, the director went out to shoot a proper kangaroo hunt that was going to go ahead anyway.
And it's essentially documentary footage.
Yeah,
isn't it
is. Yeah.
In fact, what I read is the hunters kind of asked the guy, you know, what do you want us to do? If we shoot them in the head, they sort of leap around. If we shoot them in the stomach, they do this. If we shoot somewhere. And he said, no, just do what you'd normally do. Pretend I'm not here.
Mm.
And that's what he did. And so with that in mind, I viewed it a little bit easier.
Mm.
But funnily enough, you both mentioned the editing. And in a way, it's so well edited.
Mm.
It kind of... even now works against it in the kangaroo hunts because it's so skillfully edited between this real footage and the actors and kind of there's like a sort of man to kangaroo unknown combat where it ends up with the kangaroo dying, which was staged. So there's a lot of stage stuff. But other stuff, like when they set a dog on a kangaroo and the dog pulls the kangaroo down, that clearly isn't staged.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so expertly edited together, you can't actually tell which is which.
No.
And for me, that is kind of a weakness. Stupid to say it's a weakness because obviously it's a big strength. But for me as a person, I still kind of get lifted out of being immersed in the film thinking, was that real? But like, for instance, the scene where they run over a kangaroo in the truck, where it looked real to me. Dan assures me that he's read something that is a staged thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the thing is, you can't really tell unless you sort of whiz the video backwards and forwards, and then you might be able to tell. So I thought I'd like to get that out of the way before we talk about the movie as a work of art, because I think it is a work of art, but I have a difficulty getting over that kangaroo hunting.
So what you're saying, effectively, is the editing was a victim of its own success. It looked so realistic.
For me, I'm not saying for anybody else, but for me, it didn't help me immerse myself in the story. I thought I was too busy thinking, oh, no, that's horrible. Mm.
It was a pretty disturbing scene, and I didn't know the background to it, but I went into it, you know, just watching... rawly, you know, just not knowing what happens in this film. So, yeah, it was pretty disturbing, and I was really glad to see the disclaimer at the end that reassured me that you know animals weren't actually killed for this film. It was just documentary footage, effectively.
Yeah. Or animals being killed.
So
much better.
Well, I mean,
well, it clearly is, isn't it? It is, you know, well, it's better.
But we know that goes on in Australia. Mm. We know they do have to control kangaroos, so that's all part of their culture, if you like.
They do it to sell it, or did then, to sell it off for pet food to America.
Mm. Yeah.
And they apparently, some of the welfare people were saying, you got to say, they shot a lot of footage that wasn't included because it was just too nasty, so they didn't include it. But the welfare people saying, yeah, you should put it in because this will tell people of the barbarity of it.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's a funny old... I don't think there's any film quite like that in that sense.
No. There's some. Let's see if I can find something here. Where are we?
Did we want to talk about the gambling?
I'm just going to mention. Right. The environmental bit, and this I think links into what you were just saying there, Mike. Something that was written, issue 49 of Screen Education. Andrew Zielinski wrote the following. He said, "Waking Fright can be taken as a journey through hell. The film populates the outback with aggressive males who unleash violence on the landscape, interrogating the male myth of mateship. Any positive aspect of landscape and the settler or battler is totally subverted. Instead of harmony between the landscape of the bush and the inhabitants, we have a strong dislocation. The inhabitants willingly abuse themselves, women, the bush, and kangaroos. As intruders are welcomed to this male clique, the hospitality becomes an aggressive beer-swilling odyssey. Survival here is to dominate and lower any standards to a basic instinctual drive." Mm. So it's
who wrote
very
that?
Much that was somebody. I don't know. I've closed the book now.
It's in the books. It must be good. It's in the actual book.
Hang on a sec. Let me just zip back to it again. Andrew Zielinski, who was a writer from Screen Education, a journal for media teachers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So
very perceptive.
Should we actually talk a bit about the film? The kangaroo aspect aside.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that was, yeah.
That's what I guess the show's about, isn't it?
It is, yes. Sorry, okay.
No, it's like I wasn't a criticism. I realised that I did a 10-minute rant about kangaroo shooting.
Yes, it's all right, don't worry, we'll edit that out.
Yeah. We have the technology.
Yeah. I mean, he's my favourite character, Winnie the Pooh as well. Yeah. And Little Roo.
Yes.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, I'll tell you what, shall we gather ourselves for a moment and have a little bit of music?
Should we play some music from the film?
Yes,
and then we'll come
jump back
we'll
to it afresh.
Okay. Yeah, so let me
and we'll stop talking about kangaroos.
Yeah.
Nice.
Excuse me, please.
Hi, fella. Come and have a beer with us.
Music, that
yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, it's a decent bit. And there is a very there's the whole well, I'm not even sure if it's a leitmotif, because it isn't, is it, at all. But there's the same little tune that if you listen carefully to the music throughout the entire film, it's always the same little kind of like same few notes.
Music is used very well in that movie.
Yes.
Mm. Soundtrack is it complements complements the film very well indeed.
Mm. So, I mean, interestingly, it was directed by a Canadian, Ted Kotcheff.
It seems amazing that a film so Australian is not directed by an Australian stranger.
Absolutely. Although it's something he said a number of times, he identified very strongly with it because he's from Canada. He's used to spaces that are so enormous and wide open that they become claustrophobic, and he's used to seeing sort of hard-working men doing crazy things.
Yeah.
So he absolutely sort of culturally identified with it, but was also removed enough to not have any undue reverence. He wasn't afraid to, you know, he wasn't going to pull any punches.
Mm.
So yeah.
Yeah.
What do we think? What are we going to talk about? Performances?
Well, I think... Well, sorry, jumped in there. Donald Pleasance, I mean, that might be a career highlight for Donald Pleasance.
Yeah,
and he's made literally hundreds of movies, I think. And I can't think he's any better than that.
No.
And he's both... Well, he plays an alcoholic doctor. And he plays it both jovial, very threatening... and it's just a weird mix of you can't quite. He's certainly not off of the peg character, is he? Peg alcoholic. There's such a lot going on with that character, and he nails an Australian accent so well. Yeah, you would not know he's not, and he doesn't do the classic. I can't do it, so I'm not even going to understand. But if people put on an Australian accent, you can normally. They do very, the usual stuff.
Very broad stuff,
But he isn't. He's quietly spoken, except when he rants and raves. So it's a whole mixture. And there's a little scene that it just quite uneasy and quite threatening. The main character's gone off for a walk with one of the... I think the only woman character in the movie, I think.
Yeah. No. There's the hotel receptionist lady.
Oh, no.
The fan.
Yes.
And
the although she's hardly a character, but...
she is. She's quite a good character. Okay. But anyway, yes, no, go on.
And when he comes back, Donald Pleasant, because they've all been drinking, like, continually, and they drink so much they just collapse.
Yeah.
In the stupor, then they wake up and the first thing they do is have a beer again and carry on.
Yeah.
And it's punishing to watch, actually. It's a hard watch.
Yeah.
But this time that he goes off a walk, comes back, and Donald Pleasant's like, there's a little party thing going on, and he's standing on his head, drinking beer upside down.
Yes.
And haven't we all done that at some time? But it's just like... And he actually is balancing on his head. Yeah.
There's no stunt man.
Donald Pleasance. This is him standing on his head, drinking beer.
Beer coming out of his
nostrils. And explaining that it's not gravity, it's some muscles that gets a beer. And they all stand around absolutely drunk as skunks. And it's just... It's hideous.
It's hideous. Yeah.
But compelling. It is.
And Donald Pleasance's character is just so endlessly quotable, isn't he? As well.
Some
of the little bits and pieces that he said. I know that you're quite fond. What was it? I think his very first line in the film, Chips Rafferty, who plays the local policeman, he takes John Grant, the kind of main character, into this cafe where he can get a steak. And he's like, there we go. He goes, best dollar's worth you'll ever spend, mate, and wanders off. And Donald Pleasance turns and looks at the main character for the first time and he says, all the little devils are proud of hell.
Yeah.
which is such a lovely
But he says it in a line that could have come straight out of his character in Halloween. Mm. It's that kind of...
Yeah.
Oh, it's not evil. I'm not quite sure even how you categorise it. It's pretty unique way of telling a line, though, isn't it?
Mm. But there's so many little quotable lines just in that bit. All the little devils are proud of hell. What's the other one? Oh, the one that I love when he goes, the touch of his hairy hand offended you. touch of his hand. It's just like, it's wonderful little bit of dialogue.
And there's a very unpleasant scene with him and the main character that
involves
swinging light bulbs. Yeah. We all found very disturbing.
Disturbing yet erotic.
No. I think that was you that found it erotic.
I do apologize.
I found it disturbing.
But great performance as well, though, by Gary Bond.
Absolutely.
As John Grant. Interesting thing, we mentioned about the fact that it's a film all about Australia and it's based on a classic Australian novel directed by a Canadian. The main character was played by an Englishman. Doc Tyden, another main character, English. Jeanette Hines, who is the woman that he has a sexual liaison with. Yeah. English. So there wasn't a huge amount that was actually very particularly Australian about this film.
But we touched upon this as well in another chat we talked about Walkabout, which is kind of an obvious companion piece to this, because again it was an English director, Nicholas Roeg, it was Jenny Agutter, an English actress. The boy was Nicholas Roeg's son. In fact, the only Australian at the very beginning, the dad who blows his brains out also appears in this film.
In Waking Fright, he's the guy who owns the hotel, the bar thing in Tibunda, at the beginning.
Okay. He got better then, did he?
Yeah, recovered from the head injury,
But I'm going to read you something which I think is interesting.
Let us be the judge of that.
Which is the Australian reaction to the movie. Because they said when it came out that there were people standing up in cinemas booing and shouting, "This is not us." It turns out that most of that probably never ever actually happened. Mm. And it was a bit made up. But there was a lovely thing. It was written by Greg Quill. In the Toronto Star. And it says he grasped the reason for the film's original reception in Australia, because actually now it's very well loved in Australia, and they recognise it's a historical document almost of how their society
recognised as one of the top films from Australia.
Yeah, but he said at the time, he said, "When Waking Fright so cruelly exposed the slimy underbelly of the nation's hidden psychoses, brutish misogyny, racism, bloodlust, alcoholism, a rampant gambling streak, xenophobia, and a fear of the emptiness of their own landscape. It was a shocking revelation that most Australians weren't prepared for. Not a family portrait that Australians were happy to hand around." Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually quite nice. I think it's really nicely explained. Yeah. That at the time, they were just like, "Oh, no, we don't like this," but Some decades later, people look back on it now in Australia and say, there is some truth to this. And of course, not everywhere, not in the big cities, not everywhere, but certainly in these kind of mining communities where you've got, thousands of men working in the mines.
It's a very macho society.
Oh, yeah. And they're working in hellish conditions. There was the bit where Kotcheff wanted to shoot a scene where you see Dick and Joe, the kangaroo hunting guys.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted to direct a scene showing them working in the mine, but it cost too much, and so he couldn't do it. And he said, "Afterwards, I was always sorry that I didn't shoot it, because you would have seen them working in this goddamn hellish hole, and you would have understood why they went crazy and drank and gambled and shot." So you can kind of get a little of that.
I think that actually helps him not having the money to do it, because it makes it more nightmarish, more claustrophobic, because it's a little bubble and you don't actually see any of the world outside the bubble.
No.
And I think it's very frightening. I'd consider it a horror film.
It is terrifying, because you can almost see yourself in it, getting sucked into that kind of environment, in that place, just all your human weaknesses just bit unleashed almost, you know. Well,
have I got time for a little anecdote, Dan?
You have. Can I just say quickly, one line, you just said there about, you know, everything that he was doing. There was a bit, Paul Burns, former Sydney Film Festival director, and he does a nice little bit about Waking Fright, but the final line really echoes what you just said there, and I think it is really, really important. He says, "No one forces John Grant into depravity. All they do is offer him the chance to choose it."
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like, actually, it's a fairly good point.
Very true.
Yeah, and the line, what lines, similar to the lines, you know, "Have another beer, mate," becomes one of the most horrifying lines ever, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In that film. It's just how, it's just a horror of people being pleasant to you and like being like one of your mates.
Yeah. No, that's
don't worry about, "I can't buy you one, bank. Don't worry, I'm not asking you." And just he gets in a big argument with one character. "I'm not asking you to buy me a beer, but I'm buying you a beer. Just drink it."
And also the guys, Dick and Joe, when they're having a drink with him at that little pub out in the outback, and they say, "Oh, don't worry about it, mate. When you're sorted out and you've got some money, come back and you can take us out." So it's all that whole kind of matey thing. It is a bit mad.
Matey society.
Yeah.
But I don't think we've said about Chips Rafferty enough, because he's just a stunning
character. What a
character.
Yes.
And apparently he was drinking a real beer all the time on set. He wouldn't drink fake beer like the others. And apparently I read, I guess it's true, because he was, there's one scene he couldn't get, the director was unhappy with him, he couldn't get the scene right. All he had to say was, "Have a beer." And he kept being quite pleasant, "Like, have a beer," and then knocking his own beer back. And director would, no, "You've got to be, you know, it's got to be a little bit more threatening than that." He says, "Oh, have a beer." Drinks his beer. No, look. And he's went on and on, and he's getting more and more drunk. And eventually he gets absolutely fed up with the director, and he screams, "Have a beer, mate." And the director goes, "Print, cut, print." That's it. That's, so he did like Stanley Kubrick on him, just going on and on and on until he got the cut he wanted, the take he wanted, which is probably didn't happen, of course. But it's a nice story.
It's a lovely story.
I like
story.
To believe it.
And it fits in very much with the film.
It does.
It's, you know, personally, I could talk about this film for hours.
I know what you're doing, Matt, so you don't have to talk about the second one. you're rumbled.
Unfortunately, I am looking at the time and I can see that Waking Fright time has run out, I think. There's so much to say about this movie. I know you guys don't necessarily agree with me, but from my personal perspective, I think this is in my top 10 films of all time. I love it much. It's amazing.
I would say it's a powerful film, but it's not comfortable watching.
Oh, God, no.
Not at all. It's not
a happy film, is it?
No, it's not.
No, it isn't. No, it wouldn't fly on our other, on our sister show.
Not happy enough.
Decidedly not happy. But, wow, what a movie. And I don't think we've done it justice. But if we've intrigued anybody enough to go out and watch it, please go and get it. It's available on Blu-ray and DVD.
Yeah, it's a powerful movie, and see it. It's really good.
Yeah, it's widely available on Eureka.
So Eureka Masters of Cinema. Masters of Cinema. Eureka think it's a masterpiece. You know. Pair of idiots. So, shall we have some music then,
Shall I introduce it?
Please do.
Well, you know, bit of theme going on, and it links to the next one as well. Ooh. Oh, we've got covered all the bases here. Nick Cave, who's Australian, who said about this film, "The best and most terrifying film about Australia in existence." And the track is "Running Scared," and they sure do that in the next film.
Just running scared, each place we go, so afraid that he might show. Yeah, running scared, what would I
so sure of himself, his head in the air. While my heart was breaking, which one would it be? Then you turn around.
Oh, that was all right.
That was very rousing.
Oh, that wasn't too bad at all.
Rousing or arousing?
No, rousing. Not arousing. Thank you very much.
I was just going to move away from you a bit there, Kirk.
We've gone beyond that.
Yeah. Nick Cave there.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, indeed. Thank you. Shall we talk about the next film? I can see you two are itching.
Chomping at the bit there. Yeah. Yes. Chomping at the bit.
Can't wait, can you? Okay, so the next movie, Figures in a Landscape, 1970, directed by Joseph Losey. Is it pronounced Losey or Losey?
Ask Kirk.
Well, no, because Kirk earlier pronounced it Lucy.
Lucy.
So... yeah, Jason, I'm going to go with Losey.
I think he's Losey.
Losey. Directed by Joseph Losey, who was responsible for the American remake of M. He directed The Servant, King and Country, and a number of other bits and pieces.
Modesty Blaze.
Modesty Blaze, of course.
With Monica Vitti, Terence Stamp, and Dirk Bogarde.
Because he was a frequent collaborator with Dirk Bogarde, wasn't he?
He was,
they
yeah.
They worked on about five or six films together.
Yeah.
You said Modesty Blaze. Did you know Modesty Blaze, the guy that wrote Waking Fright?
I didn't know.
The guy that wrote them both.
Really?
I think so.
Kenneth Cook?
No. Evan Jones, not the same person.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I thought you meant the book.
No, you're talking about the screenplay.
Yeah. Evan Jones did both.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I'll be.
That's
another link.
Isn't that extraordinary?
To prove that we are living in the Matrix.
And you know what? And there is a final link, isn't there, between the two films?
There's more than one link.
In the early 60s, before Kotcheff got his hands on it, the script was optioned by Dirk Bogarde, and he wanted to make the film and starring it, and he wanted it to be directed by Joseph Losey. And we didn't find any of this out until afterwards, did we? So
we planned it all.
Yes, clearly.
We're geniuses. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's Joseph Losey. It was written by the screenplay was written by Robert Shaw, none other than Robert Shaw.
Yeah,
it's to Swimming with Bow-Legged Women, based on a book by Barry England.
Bow-Legged Women,
Jaws,
Quint and Jaws.
Yeah,
here's to Swimming with Bow-Legged Women.
I'm not familiar with that line.
Really,
Jaws is that movie?
What?
Silly man. So the film stars Robert Shaw as McConaughey, called Mac throughout the film, and Malcolm McDowell as Ansel. And I believe this was only McDowell's second film after If. Lindsay Anderson's If.
Straight through If and Clockwork Orange.
Yes, we will come to that. I have some interesting factoids.
You and your factoids.
I know.
Get creamed.
I know. That's why I carry a cushion around with me at all times. McConaughey and Ansel are on the run. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. We don't know who's chasing them. But they're desperate men. Running, hands bound behind them, they must travel across an unforgiving landscape pursued by a mysterious black helicopter. From forest to rocky desert, to fields of corn, to the mountains, they're on a quest to elude their captors and reach safety, and they will do everything in their power to ensure they escape.
Mm.
You don't actually need to watch the film now, because that's all it is. But yes, so that's the summary. Which one of you chaps wants to jump in and tell us all about Figures in a Landscape?
Well, I mean, first of all, again, this is a film I've never seen before. So there's two films on the trot I've never even seen before. And I was absolutely transfixed. I mean, basically, that is the whole plot of the film. But it just, it's just unrelenting again in a similar way. The amazing landscape shots. The helicopter pilot was just unbelievable. I mean, some of the stunts, the crazy stunts he did to get in the shots. Well, I think they are. I think they're helicopter stunts because some of them are very risky. The way they got in close to the mountains, flying around valleys and gorges and such like, you know, it was just extraordinary.
And actually, Losey did say he think it's the best helicopter photography that's ever been done anywhere, and I was very much a part of it because he was the co-pilot. He was dressed as the co-pilot.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Ah, yeah, he said, so I took the chances along with the rest. You're taking incredible risks because if you have the slightest kind of motor failure at any altitude under 15,000 feet, you just go, boom. You cannot glide. We were shooting down these ravines at 25 and 50 feet.
Wow.
The scene where the helicopter... Well, there is a scene where something happens and chases someone. I don't believe that there ever was or ever will be another helicopter pilot who could have done that scene.
Wow.
Robert Shaw had great courage, but he was also bloody foolhardy, because if there'd been the slightest mistake, everyone would have been dead. Yeah. So that's... So, yes. That's,
certainly no CGI, not that existed those times, but it's all, like, real.
Absolutely.
In front of the camera. Yeah. So, and you can see it, and that's one of the reasons it's so... For me, so powerful. It's there, right in front of the eyes.
Also, I certainly don't wish to take sides, but it does seem that Losey himself tends to agree more with Kirk than with you, Mike.
About the stunts.
Well, carry on. You were telling about this.
Basically, I mean, that is... I was just transfixed, as I say.
Say stunner.
And shut up. And, just stunning cinematography. You know, I was just so intrigued as to what was going to happen to these two characters who were clearly, you know, really running for their lives in the film, you know, with their hands tied behind their back.
I mean, that's another crazy scene. They didn't have a risk assessment, did they? But they the two of them had their hands tied behind their back and going down a hillside.
Yeah.
I'm just they fell over, they would have just gone flying.
Oh, yeah, they would have scraped their faces all up.
Yeah,
on that. Yeah, it must have been like a 45-degree angle at least. Probably more acute.
Hard enough to do it when you've got two hands available.
Mm.
I mean, they might have been like breakaway ropes that they could have got out of if they wanted. But it didn't look like it.
No, impressive.
But the whole point was you were willing these characters on to try and evade this helicopter, you know, this omnipresent helicopter that was after them. And you know, it was like, oh, when are they going to get their hands unbound? You know, that was the next sequence I was waiting to see, and how they would do that. You know, and that's at the point where they reach a village and they sort of break into this kitchen and find some utensils. And you know, it was just, I was thoroughly intrigued. It was just like, what is going to happen next? You know, just. I wouldn't say a ripping yarn because it wasn't that, but it was, but an intriguing journey. Yeah.
And that is the thing, isn't it? That I mean, well, we can only assume that they're basically in a foreign country somewhere that's unnamed, and that they've escaped from captivity, and they're trying to get to the border, trying to get out of the country. That's basically all we know, isn't it?
Yeah,
totally.
The black helicopter, we don't see the people that are in it.
No.
We don't see their faces, so they have no characters. The black helicopter has its own...
Sunglasses on, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, I think, wasn't this the same year as Steven Spielberg's Duel?
Was it? I was going to mention, it's very similar the way they do it. It is. It's more... what's the word? Not metaphor. What word I'm looking for? Synagogue? Allegory. Allegory. Yeah, allegorical. That's the word. So this big black helicopter is everything that's chasing you.
Yeah.
Not just a helicopter. It's everything. Bit like the truck in Joel.
Yeah.
The monster.
It's like a spirit or
a boogeyman, if you like. Yeah. I love this movie. Should I say?
I just want to point out that again, the opening sequence when the first scene is they are running along a beach, and then they run into a forest, and you see a fantastic shot of them running, you can actually see Robert Shaw and Malcolm McDowell running through the forest as there's a long shot of them running through trees, and it's an amazing shot. But also I want to mention the soundtrack, and I didn't know the composer, but it was very Jerry Goldsmith style, very sort of avant-garde kind of sounds and echoplex sounds, and
yeah, it was like
very experimental.
It was like Planet of the Apes, yeah. Wasn't it? It made remind me of
that.
Very
similar to Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, very similar.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. Should we bash listen a to a little bit of it? Like, go on.
But Richard Rodney Bennett, who's done loads of stuff.
Let's treat ourselves.
Richard Rodney Bennett.
Richard Rodney Bennett. We did say while we were listening to that, didn't we? It was kind of like Planet of the Apes meets The Shining.
Yeah,
it's that music.
And there's big swathes in the film, which is just that music. Robert Shaw and Malcolm McDowell running about. And nothing else going on. Just that.
No dialogue.
No dialogue, nothing.
There's a thing here. I don't want to say you were talking about the sort of allegorical nature of the film. Losey himself actually said, I wanted to say in the film that it's no use trying to run away because in the present condition of the world, there is no place to run to. Ooh. If you run away from one kind of oppression, you simply find yourself in the hands of another kind of oppression, so you have to stay and fight one way or another. In this sense, it's a fable, an allegory, and audiences didn't seem to understand what I was trying to convey.
Yeah, probably explains his political persuasion, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you mentioned that he's
he was blacklisted.
He was the very first show we did Hell Drivers and Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Joseph Losey. There's actually a lovely little bit here in this book. There's a great book called Conversations with Losey, and it's basically transcript of loads of interviews with him, hours and hours. And he said that he was just finishing a film, making a film, The Big Night, and this guy called Martin Gang called me into his office and said, I want to tell you that you've been named by two people. So this is the House Un-American Activities Committee and the whole McCarthyism thing. They were persons that I'd gone to Marxist classes with. I hardly knew them and couldn't possibly even have identified them if I'd seen them on the street. Sad, sad characters who have destroyed their lives. Gang then again invited me to testify secretly, and he said that he thought he could get these witnesses to withdraw that testimony if he went in secretly. And that's the way the game was played, of course. I simply said, I'll have to think it over. And in 3 days, I was on my way to Europe. So he did exactly the same as Cy Enfield, which is, no, I'm not telling on it. I'm not ratting anybody out.
Yeah.
I'm not saving my own skin. I'm just going to leave the country.
Yeah.
And that was it.
And he made his better movies probably in Europe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And again, for instance, The Servant, which I think is a magnificent film.
Mm.
Maybe that could only have been directed by an American in the same way perhaps Waking Fright could only have been directed by a Canadian. You've got to have that kind of cultural distance to do it some justice.
Go-Between as well.
Go-Between.
He made some terrific
Remains
movies.
Of the Day as well, directed by an American.
Oh, well, I thought you were talking about Joseph Losey.
James Ivey.
Interestingly, going back to the making of this film, apparently Losey, he was given the book to read and he hated it. Really didn't like it at all.
Oh, I bet you enjoyed reading that, Dan.
But then he was given the script that had been written by an American who worked in London. And he didn't like that either. So he decided that he said he found the book very amoral, violence for violence's sake, with nothing to say.
Hmm.
So he decided not really do it.
Hmm.
Eventually, though, Robert Shaw, who he knew and liked, and whose written work he really admired, because Robert Shaw was a novelist and playwright, as well as an actor, Robert Shaw came to him and said, I've been offered this picture. I think I can make something of the part. I'm getting a lot of money. You can get a lot of money. Say yes, otherwise the whole project will fall through because they've got another director on it. And this other director, it wasn't working out. And he said, I guarantee you that between you and me, we will get a script which you will like to shoot.
Mm.
They offered him more money than he'd ever received. So he decided to say yes. And basically, Robert Shaw, they spent like 3 weeks, day and night, writing the script. And it's one of those things, you think that this is a fairly new thing, but apparently they were turning up sometimes on set with new pages of the script that had only been written the night before.
Wow.
You know, Robert Shaw made lots of promises that he didn't really deliver on. I think he liked to work to a tight deadline. So he was writing pages of the script in the evening, and the following day they were actually filming them.
Okay.
But yes, I thought that was fairly interesting.
The script is kind of remarkable because it's very strong echoes of Harold Pinter.
Yeah, Pinteresque. Yes. Yeah.
It's very, very strong echoes.
Mm.
And of course, he was in The Birthday Party.
Yes, Robert Shaw
and
in The Birthday
Party.
And
it's very similar dialogue, isn't it? And of course, Birthday Party was a band for Nick Cave that we played earlier.
Yes,
so you see how it all works together.
Nicely segued there.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly,
I nearly dropped the ball there, but I got to the line eventually.
Honestly, the listeners out there have got no idea
the work we do, the sheer hard work and the hours.
The blood and tears.
And sweat. Don't forget sweat. Don't talk about Donald Pleasance again.
I've got to admit, we watched this, didn't we, together?
Yeah.
And Mike, you'd seen it before. Kirk,
never.
You hadn't, and I hadn't.
Mm.
And we watched it. We watched it just after Waking Fright. I think I was still buzzing on Waking Fright because I sat down and I watched this with enormous anticipation, and I didn't like it.
Mm.
What I did, though, was because you two liked it so much, I thought, I'm missing something here. So on Sunday, I watched it again.
Right.
I thought, I'm going to give it a second chance. Now I know what to expect. I'm going to sit and watch it, give it a second chance. And I still wasn't particularly keen on it. it did. I've got to admit, I agree with your view on the cinematography. It does look beautiful.
Mm.
But, and the dialogue, I love the dialogue, that Pinteresque thing. But the two things for me didn't quite mesh. It was like Harold Pinter wrote Steven Spielberg's Duel. It's like Pinter's dialogue and Duel, this thing that's chasing it.
Yeah.
So, and for me, the two didn't quite work, but that's just my opinion, and I'm acutely aware of the fact that you two violently disagree and really, really did love it.
Mm.
So I would suggest to the listeners that they listen to these two and not me on this particular one.
But, yeah.
But, yeah. You know, an interesting film. Do you want to hear something quite interesting about it as well?
Go on then.
Go on then.
Malcolm McDowell. So they're talking about, again, in Losey's book, he's talking about the characters and the actors. He said, McDowell is very good, and out of it, he got the Clockwork Orange part.
While he was at Dartmouth,
Kubrick rang me there, and he said, I'm considering McDowell. What kind of actor is he? And I said, tell me what kind of character it is, and I'll tell you. He told me, and I said, I think he's perfect for it. He has a kind of clown's face, which is extraordinary, what Fellini calls a rubber face. And there's evil in his face too, which does not mean that he is at all an evil man, on the contrary. And basically, on the strength of that, I think it sounds like Kubrick was persuaded to put McDowell in A Clockwork Orange. But apparently the two of them didn't get along on set, Robert Shaw and Malcolm McDowell. Mm. It got quite destructive, and there was a bit here. What was it? They were basically antagonistic as people. They had a couple of near fights. Shaw can be extremely difficult, and he used to delight in tormenting Malcolm, playing practical jokes on him. And Malcolm would leap on him and attack him. All that, in a sense, helped the film, and also their sense of humour. It turns out they didn't get on. There was a lot of, going on.
I agree. That comes across in the film, because it is almost like McDowell's character is a protege of Robert Shaw's character.
Mm.
But also there's obviously a military thing going on there, a military cultural thing going on, whereby Shaw's the experienced sergeant major type, he's belittling McDowell for being weak and feeble and lots of sentiment like that. So that kind of anger and that kind of bitterness almost came out in the film, obviously, if that was happening in real life, so that's interesting.
I must admit, it's although I wasn't hugely entertained by it, it's an intriguing film. There was a lot there to unpick, and I certainly would recommend it to people, even though I wasn't that keen. Can you believe that we've already talked for very nearly an hour?
Good grief.
Really?
Oh, heavens above, we like the sound of our own voices, don't we?
We do, too much.
Especially yours, Dan. Nice.
Can we just mention...
It's like melted chocolate.
Sorry, can we just mention the availability of the film?
Yes, the availability. Yes, it's... Well, as we said, they've both kind of like been lost films to an extent. This was not available for years and years and years. It now is available. I think 2 years ago it was released on Blu-ray in America. You can buy it from America. It is region locked, unfortunately, so you need a multi-region Blu-ray player. But it is also available on DVD, isn't it?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Did you not know that? Yes, it is available on DVD, and you can buy it from Amazon, and I don't believe that that is region locked. You can certainly pick that up.
Hmm.
Mike.
What?
Sorry, you were waving at me.
No, it wasn't. That wasn't a wave. That
you
was
had
a,
your hand up.
That's a...
Hello.
A secret hand signal.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So, Mike, what music have you brought for us? What are we playing out today?
Well, I've got one other connection between these two movies.
A bombshell.
Can you believe it?
An embarrassment of riches.
Because Donald Pleasance and Malcolm McDowell have actually played the same character.
Dun, dun, dun.
No.
Can you believe it?
No.
No.
No, really, no.
Shall I tell you the character?
Oh, please do.
Dr. Loomis. Does that help you at all?
Dr. Loomis. No.
Yes.
Oh, Dan, go on then.
No, it's just that I've already seen the track.
Oh, okay.
It's queued up.
Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween, yes. Dr. Loomis, Donald Pleasance. When it's rebooted in 2007, who was Dr. Loomis? Malcolm McDowell. Ooh, yes. Wow.
Just as we planned.
So I think we should have a little bit of Halloween to celebrate. But Dan, do your famous little...
My famous little thing. Yes, folks, we are going to play you out with the theme from Halloween, but in the splendid 8-bit version.
Bye, folks.
Bye.
See you next time.